and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The day today is January 16th, 2026, and this is episode 573. I am the co-host, Mark Ames. I'm coming to you from snowy, bitter, cold Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe and support the show, please. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd to join the Warnerd Legion. And I'm on the line, of course, with the Warnerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in southern Italy, back in southern Italy. How you doing?
I'm pretty good, considering, I mean, we made our trip up to the dentist this week, and it turns out I have a root canal infection in one of the teeth that has a cap glued onto it. So they're going to have to take the cap off, bring in another guy, periodontist, to drill through the tooth and drain it of its horrible essences, and then put the cap back on. So I'm not looking forward to that, hopefully the thing will be dead then forever. We can have an exorcism for it.
I didn't know that. I mean, I thought like a cap, when you get a denture cap or whatever, that's supposed to solve it. That's it. You can't have anything more bad going on anymore. It's like an infected prosthetic leg or something. Like, it's not supposed to happen.
Yeah. Well, I grind my teeth. So, I generate a lot of pressure in the teeth.
So they tell you it's all your fault then, huh?
Yeah. You're a freak. That's it.
God. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, it sounds painful and the kind of thing that would give you no respite. And which, you know, which pretty much mirrors 2026.
Absolutely.
Globally.
No respite
no
anywhere.
Respite. Yeah. And
just plain spite, maybe, but yes. No respite.
Trump's amazing. He gets more active with every day. It's like Freddy Krueger with, you know, the more children's souls he gets into his body, like the bigger and stronger he gets.
I wonder if some doctor has told him he's going to die soon.
I know.
And he wants to do as much harm as he can.
I mean, either way, I was thinking about that this morning too. That's funny that mortality seems to be one of the drivers here. I mean, one of the drivers is immortality, the fact that he survived the assassination attempt, and two assassination attempts, and, you know, the greatest lawfare attack on a major presidential candidate in history, as far as I know. And he survived all that. So that gave him power. But also, he's almost 80 and he's thinking about mortality. He's not in great shape. Somehow he has energy, but it sort of seems like he's borrowing the rest of the future fuel to do everything now, whatever's left of the fuel, to get in everything now.
Yeah. There were a lot of kings who, when they reached the upper decades of age, started killing a lot of people because there's something almost hardwired in the human brain that thinks, if I can kill a lot of other people, maybe they'll leave me alone.
Yeah. And you know, like the Greenland thing, like there's such an urgency on that. I mean, I would say the chances now that the U.S. takes it are at least 50-50. At least, if not greater. And, you know, you could see what Trump sees the map change, the color change. People who never played Risk are so confused by this. Yeah. And, or who were never on the right, I guess. But the map change, and that will be a physical real estate manifestation of his legacy, along with, you know, taking out some of the baddies, starting with Maduro and whoever else is on the list that is take-outable. Yeah.
And, of course, the Danish mechanics who are on the ground trying to service a few trucks.
Yeah. I think I saw that Germany sent 13 military personnel to Greenwood.
Oh, that'll do it.
I know. I mean, I think they're going to have a little rave party there or something. I don't know. There's really nothing they can do. When they try and suck up to Trump, which they've done, it only invites more derision and a greater desire. And then when they start talking tough, as they've done in the last couple of days, that also is a red flag. And like, okay, you want to talk tough? I dare you. I mean, this is what happens.
I think, and I speak as a victim of bullying straight through my first 14 years of school. I think when you eliminate bullying in the schools, as Northern Europe at least has done, you really deprive the kids who survive of an important skill. Like, you do not try to gussy up to Trump. You do not try to grovel.
Yes. I mean, they don't know how to talk tough. Like, it's so awkward. And it's so hollow because they've already subordinated themselves completely to the U.S., thinking they were like one of the appendages on this giant stomping all over the world. Like, we're part of this. Yeehaw! It's like, no, you're not, actually, if the giant turns against you. And so so if you start trying to threaten the U.S., I mean, there aren't a lot of choices here. I mean, this is, I think, going to be a theme for this year. Like, when you look at Venezuela, there aren't a lot of choices. There aren't a lot of choices when you have a military power that is unlike any other military power targeting you. Your choices are not great. Your best option, your best choice always is just how to survive and hope you make it to the next regime president, which may take a different tack. Like, that's kind of the best strategy.
But, you know, there is one possibility for the long term in Venezuela, and that's the agreement between some of the Colombian former insurgent groups that have officially laid down their arms and the Maduro loyalists who are now supposedly making their way to Western Colombia, which is still a thickly forested area where they could hole up and do some raids, do some damage. Of course, the U.S. would have to, like, invade fully, Vietnam style. And I don't know if there's anybody stupid enough to do that in D.C.
But, no, you bring up a really good point. There will be possibilities, though. I mean, that's why Trump is keeping in Delcy and the rest of the regime, I think, to make sure that there isn't that insurgency or to try to do their best. However, as far as I can tell, the U.S. does have plans to send in, well, at least under cover of like Blackwater type, you know, private mercenary groups. In fact, I think Eric Prince has already been his, whatever his company is called, and he keeps changing the name of it. Academy or whatever, that his is one of the private mercenary companies that is being talked about that the U.S. wants to send in to, I don't know, protect oil fields that it thinks are going to be American or American aligned. And that is going to, so when you insert Americans in there, then you provide targets and then we'll see what happens. But you're right. I mean, the ELN, that sort of insurgency depends or will have a much better chance if there's a real full-scale American.
Yeah, and the ELN is the leading interlocutor in these negotiations, supposedly, because they're pretty fierce. Considering they started out as a bunch of Catholics, they're pretty intense. Mm-hmm. They got that old 30 years war spirit going for them.
So obviously we want to talk today about Iran, you know, another ongoing sort of, you know, hotspot in the world that we've done many episodes on, including, I think, one of our earliest emergency radio warned episodes. And by the time we've recorded this, it's gone from yet another in a series of many protests that broke out to a protest to a violent protest with hundreds or thousands killed, and a sort of wild online mass propaganda campaign that recalls all the worst regime change propaganda campaigns, but also is kind of new, crazier level elements. But as we're recording this right now, it seems that that for now, the protest and the threats by Trump to bomb Iran again have all kind of quieted down, that the repression by the Iranian state and the lack of actual a combination of that and Trump not actually bombing seems to have, at least for now, quieted things down. But there is also a big blackout, except for all of the tens of thousands of Starlink transmitters and so on that were snuck into Iran. I mean, we got to assume CIA, Mossad, and so on, snuck them in. But aside from that, there is a blackout. In fact, I almost got somebody inside Iran to come on the show, but then the blackout hit. This was a couple of days ago, and it's just, so it didn't work out, but hopefully we'll get them on at some point. I know there's a lot you want to talk about too, John. So I'm going to just a very kind of quick background on what happened here. Obviously, we had the 12-day war in June when Israel tried to do a full decapitation of the regime and probably a regime change, or if not a regime change, at least to break the state. And then Trump came in at the end with his bombing licks in, and then the war ended for a variety of reasons. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that Israel and the U.S. were literally running out of anti-missile defense systems.
Or even offensive missiles. I mean, it was an extraordinary exchange of missiles between two cutting-edge states as far as missile armaments in the Middle East. And we only saw really half of it. And the censorship with the full cooperation of the U.S. press by the Israeli press seemed to stop paying attention to the Iranian air-to-surface missiles once they landed. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them, I thought at the time, a lot of them landed in what looked like high-value areas.
Yeah.
And I found a few stories, just a few, but yeah, they describe unprecedented destruction in Israel, which one didn't get talked about very much. But
well, and even more so, it was clear that as the 12-day war went on, Israel was hitting fewer and fewer of the Iranian missiles. The Iranians were learning. The Israelis were running out of systems and starting to try to conserve some of them, but also the Iranians were learning fast. That's how you learn, is through actual field, experiments.
Yeah, they had some of those missiles that would do evasive action near the target. So you'd have one going down in a beautiful geometry class arc, and then it would zip to the side and explode.
Yeah, and just the whole changing around the mix of cruise missiles and drones and different types of missiles. They have a pretty variegated, we talked about this last year, quite a variegated missile arsenal the Iranians do. Yeah. I mean, that's where they put a lot of their efforts. And it's actually clear it's kind of paid off. I mean, we should do an episode on missiles sometime in the near future, because also in the Ukraine war, I mean, you could see how missiles are replacing air power. I mean, so are drones, of course, but missiles are a layer of that. And, you have been talking a lot about, like, the bleak future for manned aircraft. And I think missiles are really going to be more and more a part of that as they can bring prices down of missiles and produce more, and they can do more things. They're really effective. I mean, you see this in the Ukraine war particularly. But you saw this in the 12-day war too.
Hunting people. I mean,
yeah, yeah.
Very PKD scenes of some guy trying to take shelter in the ruins of a blasted tank, and this thing just finds him.
Right, but I'm even talking about like the Iskander missiles, like the ballistic missiles that Russia's been using. And then, you know, they fired another one of those Arezhniks, the new hypersonic nuclear missile, but they're firing them without warheads because just the impact from the kind of like, explosive-less submunitions create their own massive, you know, craters. They fired one over Lvov, or outside of Lvov, and I think they hit a repair plant where Ukraine is repairing F-16s and some of their Sukhois they still have left, and probably have a lot of NATO people mixed in there. And it's one of the few things, it's like an absolute, like you said with Israel, an absolute state secret. Like you could see from afar on social media, the Arezhnik, that last part, it looks like kind of War of the Worlds. Like you see this kind of cloud and then this, pew, 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 these like lights flashing down to earth, but you cannot get near where the actual blast site was. And if it didn't go off well, I mean, having watched this war, the Ukrainians would be having fun with it, right? They'd be having fun with it. But they are not showing it. But the mayor of Lviv did say that it caused a lot of damage. That was kind of the most we got out of them. And it's otherwise the kind of the silence they're having on it is, says a lot. And
yeah,
I think, you know, I think the question with the Arezhnik and other missiles is just how much they can bring the cost down and how much they can scale actual production of these ballistic missiles. But with the Iskanders, they've been causing a lot of damage. Iskanders using drones for intelligence, plus, you know, human intelligence. Like they've been landing these Iskander ballistic missiles on these gatherings of new recruits as they're having their parade, boom, or gatherings of NATO. I mean, they won't admit this publicly, but this has happened a few times, like NATO advisors in a hotel. And then the Iskander hits it. So it's not just a drone. They're using a ballistic missile, you know, to take out important
assets.
Yeah, well,
you can always apologize officially for that. Like, whoops, sorry about that.
So getting back to Iran, that war, let's not forget, that war killed over 1,000 Iranians. Like, these things are just... It's just like, ho-hum. 1,000 Iranians, mostly, you know, it was overwhelmingly the Israelis that did the killing in that war in June. Then you had what were called snapback sanctions. And this kind of led to the first protest in December. But the snapback sanctions, I don't want to get too into this, but just put it this way. With part of the nuclear deal that Obama agreed to, you know, that Obama, it was like one of the best things he did, was his nuclear deal with Iran to sort of put their nuclear program on ice and lower the sanctions and lower all the heat and, you know, try and normalize relations. Trump, you know, campaigned in 2016 on breaking that and said it was the worst deal ever. And he broke it. And at that time, in the first Trump term, the Europeans were very angry about that and didn't want to go along with reimposing all those really hard sanctions on Iran, which caused an enormous amount of economic pain. But this time around, Trump wanted to reimpose the snapback sanctions and get the UN to reimpose it. And for various reasons on how this whole deal was put together, basically the Europeans, led by France and Germany, were kind of the main deciders whether these sanctions would be put back on Iran or not. Iran's position was, look, Trump, you're the one that pulled out. You ripped up the treaty. So we're not in treaty. We don't have to abide by it anymore. And the Europeans always agreed with that before. But trying to suck up to Donald, their new strategy, as they call him, daddy, they decided with 30 days left on France and Germany's legal ability to reimpose snapback sanctions. They decided not to wait, reimpose the snapback sanctions. So they start to really take effect in November. And then the real currency, which is already doing poorly, collapses. Inflation goes through the roof. And the market sellers, who are a very powerful sort of constituency in Iran, in fact, they played a big role in the 1979 revolution. Yeah. They took to the streets because they couldn't do business anymore. I mean, a lot of these guys are selling electronics from overseas that rely on being able to, you know, convert the real currency. And when the real collapses, nobody can, they can't even buy their stuff overseas. And when they have it, no one can afford it. So they took to the streets on December 28th. And December 29th, right? Like, so at very first, what I think is interesting is the initial reaction by these sort of reformist, moderate, whatever you call them, the reformist president, Pezeshkian, who kind of surprised everybody by winning the election, the presidential election in Iran in 2024. Remember, Raisi, who was, you know, the so-called hardliner, he was really Khamenei's pick probably to take over the country after the Ayatollah Khamenei dies. Raisi was killed in a mysterious helicopter crash in 2024. I have speculated in a newsletter that there's a very good chance that Israel or the West had something to do with it. It's not like Israel is averse to assassinating its enemies. Mm. And it's not like Israel has never arranged air crashes before. But anyways, I think everybody was sort of surprised that Pezeshkian, who was considered very urbane, I think he's a heart surgeon, was not even considered anything like a likely winner earlier in the summer, but he wound up winning, and it was like a protest vote. And right. So Pezeshkian's response to these protests was initially to come out and say, you're right to protest. We're failing you. It's not just America that's doing this. We are also making mistakes. He went and met with protesters, and he fired the central bank chief. So that was the initial response. But then, almost immediately, within a day or two after the protests start, and they're still very peaceful, university students starting to join them, and then you have the account, Mossad spokesman, the Mossad's online account, tweeting out in Persian, let's come out to the streets together. The time has come. We are with you, not just from afar and verbally. We are with you in the field as well. That's the translation from Persian. Yeah. So you started to have the worst ghouls openly encouraging and openly trying to inflame the situation. On January 2nd, you had Mike Pompeo, hardline pro-Israel Zionist and Trump's former CIA chief, tweeting out, the Iranian regime is in trouble. At this point, again, protests are still peaceful, and the government is laying back for the most part. Bringing in mercenaries is its last best hope. Riots in dozens of cities. Yada, yada, yada. Happy New Year to every Iranian in the streets, also to every Mossad agent walking beside them.
Yeah, that last phrase is very telling. And it's an old intelligence trick to get your enemy to watch, rather than watching you, watch the person beside him to see if he's a traitor. And there are real grounds to think that Israel's doing something more than boasting, because,
absolutely.
I mean, I remember the attack on an Iranian nuclear scientist, which killed him. And it was carried out, it turned out, not by a giant team of Israeli saboteurs, as Israel claimed, but satellite directing a machine gun that was completely automated and just set up in a traffic circle that was part of his commute home, and they just riddled his limo with heavy caliber bullets. So they do have a real...
Also in the 12-day war, they had all kinds of agents who had already brought in disassembled drones and then assembled them and used them to kill generals, to kill scientists, to work on decapitating the regime. Mm. And some of them were eventually caught. Like, I, you know, we marveled at the time at how porous Iran was. And that's kind of been going on for a while. And I think that's talking to people, you know, that's a consequence of a lot of the corruption and kind of the, I don't know, state decay is, I mean, it is kind of that. And also, though, you know, it's not a totalitarian regime that you might think. It's not, you know, it's not a hardcore police state, but it can be a really ruthless regime when it's threatened. There was, as things started to heat up, you had in tandem the U.S. and Israel officials doing their best to heat things up. And, you know, you had Trump after, like right after he invades Venezuela and takes Maduro, he then goes out and starts, and he warned if Iran starts killing people like they have in the past, I think they're going to get hit very hard by the United States. So Trump starts threatening to bomb Iran. They're talking about regime change. You had an Israeli minister on January 8th, Amichai Eliyahu, saying that Israeli agents went on Israel radio and said Israeli agents are operating on the ground in Iran. So at that point, it seemed to me, and then at the same time, you know, you had some of the protesters starting to turn violent, and some of the reactions were violent, but there was not the mass violence by the state yet. But you did have some of the protests starting to turn bigger and more violent. And the state reaction at this point was not as harsh of a crackdown. I'm talking before Ali Khamenei's big speech on, was it the 8th or the 9th? But on January 6th, you had Reza Pahlavi, so this is the son of the Shah, they call him the exiled crown prince, issued a statement calling for more protests. And that did help inflame things. So, you know, the Shah, the son, this so-called crown prince, he lives in like what, Northern Virginia or Maryland? I mean, he lives, you know, he lives where all the defense contractors live.
Yeah, he went from punchline to serious contender in no time at all.
I mean, John, you know, there is hatred of the regime and it seems to increase the younger you go. And I think also the younger people, probably younger males, are not as liberal as people might want to believe. Like, and the Shah represents the antithesis of the Islamic Republic, right? So if you're young and you hate this regime that's been in power and you don't think these economic sacrifices that people have to make because the hegemon is constantly punishing the country, you don't think they're worth it for you, then you're going to support the guy that they hate the most. If that's who they hate the most, that's who you're going to support. You support Israel. I don't know if you've noticed this going back to, I think just before, let's say, that Israel started actually bombing Iran, but there was a lot of talk among younger, again, it's not all youngers, but this is a portion of younger Iranians who were starting to say, basically, screw Palestinians in Gaza. They're Arabs. Why should we sacrifice for them?
Yeah.
There's a lot of nationalism.
There's a deep rift there. There always has been. Yeah. And I've seen some sites that do crossed flags, you know, the old Iranian flag and the Israeli flag.
Yeah. So, you know, then you have here Israel reporting on Channel 14, a big Israeli channel. Foreign actors are arming the protesters in Iran with live firearms, which is the reason for the hundreds of regime personnel killed. Everyone is free to guess who is behind it. That's the correspondent Tamir Morak. So they're letting him know.
Does that mean Israel implicating itself with a little wink?
Yes. And I think, again, I think what happens is, look, when you want a regime collapse, Or, I mean, the Israelis, I don't know about the Americans, but the Israelis definitely want a collapse of the Iranian state. I'm sure a chunk of the American deep state wants that too, for it to fracture into subunits and to weaken it. And when you impose these sanctions knowing they're going to create unrest, and so you're already prepared then for how you're going to exploit that unrest and how to heat it up. So you've already smuggled in tens of thousands of Starlinks. You have this, you know, oligarch military contractor, Elon Musk, controlling both Twitter, which disseminates the information, and Starlink, which is the technology to disseminate the information. And he's, you know, deep in the Pentagon. So you have that all prepared. Now, your problem, your first problem you run up against after the protests start in December 28th is that Pezeshkian is the reformist. He's doing the kind of counterinsurgency, you know, to put it one way, that you don't want, which is meeting with the protesters, lowering the, you know, the heat. You know, I'm sure they have assets and intelligence, and they just, you know, this is how it is with any regime, Western or Eastern or whatever. You know that there are powerful elements in Iran who don't like Pezeshkian and who don't want to do this and who know that the West is involved and see this as a threat and want to stomp hard now. But they gave Pezeshkian a chance to see if he could tamp down the protests through, you know, carrots, as they say. And so that's not what Israel and Washington want. They want to heat things up. They want people killed. So you bring, you know, you bring in the rioters, you set buildings on fire, you create enough chaos where Pezeshkian is sidelined and Pezeshkian's, you know, way of doing things is sidelined, and you empower the hardliners. It's an old strategy.
Yep.
That's what they did. John, you wanted to talk about some of the Western media on this and the role of the West in this?
Yeah. And this is happening at a very unusual time in at least American discourse, because a few days ago, this nice liberal white woman got shot four times in the face in Minnesota by an ICE agent who called her a fucking bitch or something. Mm-hmm. And since then, what remains of the American liberal consensus is up in arms, although it's striking to me to see how feeble they are compared to what they were in their prime. And I'm old enough to remember sort of their prime. But in a sense, that's fine with the Trump administration, because what they want is an opposition that's powerful enough to cause a little fuss and force their own spokespeople to snap back at news conferences in jingoistic phraseology that can warm the hearts of their loyalists. And Trump has done so many intentional provocations in recent months that it's kind of hard to remember when the allegations about Epstein Island and all that started. Like, what are they trying to bury? I can't even remember now.
Absolutely.
Because they've buried it so well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, the economic problems. I mean, everybody's unhappy in this country economically. Yeah. Trump was supposed to, you know, that's why Biden lost, because people were hurting economically. That's one of the main reasons, on top of, I think, lying about Biden's state of mental health. And I think that had a much bigger impact. It's also, I got to say, that's something the liberals have buried, because the press buried it. And it was like a shock to everybody, only because it was buried. It was one of the most insane things. But then Trump comes to power and he's done absolutely nothing. In fact, he, you know, imposes tariffs, and that obviously makes inflation go up a bit. And his response is to say inflation is a hoax and affordability is a liberal hoax. And now he's sort of realizing, well, that won't get me elected. So either I'm going to cancel elections or I got to try and do something. But, you know, presidents do, like, and Trump is just an extreme version of this. It's a lot harder for a president constitutionally and otherwise, to really fix the economy, especially if your politics are right wing. You can't do more privatization and more tax cuts. You know, like the economy has, people have other problems. But where you have complete leeway, where there's no democratic control whatsoever, is in foreign policy. And if you're the type of guy who wants to take advantage of that power maximally, you know, like Trump, you can. Yeah. But he, and then he's kind of trying to use similar powers, national emergencies, to clamp down on blue cities like Minneapolis. In fact, he's threatening to invoke the Insurrection Act to bring in the army onto the streets. And as you said, distract. I mean, it is a distraction. It's not making him more popular, though. One thing I would say, it is making him more popular. Like the New York Times, the major media, they're not angry at him over Venezuela, and they're not angry at him over Iran at all. At all. And that's putting it mildly.
It's very, very strange. I mean, I guess we inherited the idea that they tilted a little bit to the left of an imaginary center. And that's just not true. They like a news entity that they can identify and that they know very well, like the American government. They like it when those entities take action and they get to send their little gung-ho people along with them. And that's really the only bias they've shown.
Yeah, it's pretty grim. That and obviously anything for Israel. Those are their two biases. And so Trump knows he can get the center-left press, basically the establishment press, to talk less about Epstein, which is an embarrassment because Epstein also, you know, I don't know if you saw this, but there is a committee hearing in Congress where they are supposedly going to hold hearings on Epstein, but they're going to fix it because it's Republicans. And so they've subpoenaed Bill and Hillary Clinton, who are refusing to abide by the subpoena. And then now they're being threatened with contempt charges for that. They're not wrong, though. I mean, Clinton was at least as close to Epstein as Trump.
Clinton probably was more nervous and more discreet and therefore relied more on proxies like Epstein.
Another thing I just wanted to say is that that in the end you've had, depending on who you sort of believe, but at least somewhere between, I don't know, 150 and a few hundred Iranian police security forces killed. So that points to a lot of violence. On the other side, you have anywhere from several hundred to 2,000 to several thousand more protesters killed. And we don't know how many were killed, but we do know that the source most relied on by the Western press, the two main sources for death tolls, and since we started this show 10 years ago, we've always talked about how death tolls, either reporting and inflating them or suppressing them, are a key part of war propaganda in every war we've covered. You either amplify them when it serves the empire's purposes to weaken a regime, or you suppress them when death tolls are bad news, such as the death toll in Yemen when the U.S.-backed Saudi war was going on there, or you suppress, for example, you amplify and inflate and exaggerate Russian deaths in the Russia-Ukraine war to make it seem like we're on the cusp of winning. Just keep the war effort going another year and we'll win. But you suppress, with the connivance of the U.S. media, Ukrainian casualties, which we still don't know 4 years in. Yeah. But so here with this one, we have two Washington-based outfits, one called the Abdurrahman Bahraman Center for Human Rights in Iran. And just here in the gray zone, they talk about how it last year, 2 years ago, the National Endowment for Democracy, our old friends, we did a two episode series on them. They released a press release just 2 years ago calling this group, quote, a partner of the National Endowment for Democracy. So that's one National Endowment for Democracy partner. And the other one is Human Rights Activists in Iran, has a really slick website. I was checking them out. And they also started receiving aid from the NED going back to 2021. So, you know, and they're both Washington-based. And so you have, you know, these two organizations funded by the group that the National Endowment for Democracy, which, you know, the founder of it said, told the Washington Post that a lot of what we do today was done covertly 25 years ago by the CIA. It's an arm of the CIA, or let's say a CIA cutout.
Right.
You know, this Abdurrahman Bourmand Center on their board of directors is none other than Francis Fukuyama. So, you can't make this shit up. So
they're very forgiving. So you got it wrong. Okay.
Yeah. All the same people are there. What I found kind of interesting was that these outfits, you know, I think what they try to do to maintain their credibility generally is they try to keep their death tolls, at least for a while, like as close to accurate as they can get so that they're not shown up as complete liars. They need that credibility, especially for when you do post the lie. It has more credibility. It's just, again, an old propaganda trick. So their numbers were still in the low thousands, but that didn't seem to really do it. So you had other people coming in, other groups, other outfits, other mouthpieces, Laura Loomer and so on, saying, no, the death toll is 10,000, 20,000, 50,000. There's this one, you know, Center Iranian Voices. There's a lot of that online. I don't know. You're not on Twitter. You're lucky. But it's the same shit you've seen in every regime change operation, like Iran, et cetera. I mean, Ukraine, Maidan, so on. There's always, when you express skepticism or you say, you know, I've seen this before, you get these people saying, you're not an authentic Ukrainian or Iranian or right. Brazilian or whatever. Keep your mouth shut. You don't know, you know, fuck you. Like, they get really angry and violent. And that does scare off a lot of well-meaning people on the left. They don't want to cross authentic voices. You know, you're kind of trained not to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a big failing in their way of evaluating the voices they encounter online, because some of the sleaziest people in the world are emigre lobbyists.
Yes, absolutely. Like, I mean, Yasha Levine wrote a lot about weaponized immigrant communities who are useful to the empire. The most obvious one being the Cuban diaspora, but also, you know, the Ukrainian diaspora. We saw they're weaponized even more so in Canada than here. Over and over, they are to advance, you know, the empire's goals. And they have a mutual interest. The diaspora usually does want a regime change and they want to go back and run the place. So there's kind of, you know, common interest there. But as I said, where we are right now is it seems to have quieted down. Trump is saying that he is not going to bomb, but at the same time, they're moving a lot of, the U.S. is moving a lot of military assets into Iran. There's so much bullshit being put out there. Now that he's not bombing, the Israeli media is, through, you know, their friends in America and so on, is putting out all this guff that Netanyahu counseled Trump not to bomb, that it would be bad for the protesters.
Right.
It's such bullshit. It's like, bomb, bomb, bomb. You're not going to bomb. Okay, tell everybody I told them not to bomb. Tell everyone I was the one. I'm in control here. Which would be really funny.
Yeah.
But, you know, on a kind of grimmer note on this, one thing that's very unusual, reading and listening to some Iranians, longtime researchers and academics, you know, talking about this, is that some of those scenes, those really gruesome scenes of dead Iranian protesters lined up, you know, in these sort of open air morgues, those were shown on Iranian state television. That's how we got a lot of those pictures. And that is very unusual from what I understand. In the past, Iranian state television, for obvious reasons, like a lot of governments, doesn't want to show shot demonstrators, murdered demonstrators.
Yep.
And people are still kind of trying to make sense why, because this is so unusual in Iran and for a lot of countries, why would they show so many killed demonstrators on top of killed security personnel? Mm. And, you know, one thought is that this would presumably be part of scaring people from going out onto the streets. But it's also destabilizing potentially because you're showing you're killing your own people. This could inflame. So another possibility also is that the government also is trying to regain some credibility. As I said, there's just such a disinformation, misinformation overload pushed from outside and from inside, but you know, straight out of Washington and Tel Aviv and through Twitter, that by showing some of the consequences of this, they're showing that these demonstrations have consequences. It's going to shock and horrify people, which I think the government is hoping, and it did, you know, take some of the wind out of the sails of the demonstrators who might think they're going out and having fun without really knowing how bad it is. But it also establishes some credibility, some narrative credibility for the government.
Yeah.
At a time when there is all this disinformation, it is a surprise. So people will be saying, wow, the government is showing this. Why?
Yeah.
And so I think that's really interesting. And another little thing I wanted to say as well is that, you know, talking about the violence on the side of the demonstrators, I mean, this started out very peaceful and it got increasingly violent. And as we've said, you know, the violence was inflamed deliberately by the U.S. and the Israelis.
Yep.
And by Western-backed diaspora groups. But this is from the Financial Times today, describing some of the violence. And the Financial Times, this is not, you know, tanky press. Here's what they write. Testimonies from the scenes of the unrest, some spoken directly to the Financial Times, in addition to those smuggled out through intermediaries, reveal a muddied account of the turmoil itself in which agitators mingled with genuine protesters. So even they're writing that there were agitators. Clashes claimed the lives not just of unarmed citizens who formed part of the leaderless crowds, but of well-equipped security personnel. Quote, this is a demonstrator in Tehran talking to the FT. There were groups of men in black clothes, agile and quick. They would set one dustbin on fire and then quickly move to the next target, unquote. Another witness in Western Tehran told the FT he saw about a dozen fit men, quote, looking like commandos, unquote, dressed in similar black clothing, running through the area and calling on people to leave their homes and join the protests. Quote, they were definitely organized, but I don't know who was behind them, unquote. So again, you have the Israelis bragging that we have people there. You have Mike Pompeo bragging that Mossad is there, that they have their people there. And here you have the Financial Times reporting that there were well-trained, organized groups of agitators stoking violence. So where we are right now, just as we record this, the protests have largely seem to have stopped. We don't know a lot about what's going on because of just the morass of disinformation all over the place, because of the Iranian state's blackout on the internet. And I think they've found ways to track down a lot of these Starlink terminals and transmitters. Like I think a lot of Starlink has been kind of shut down, not completely, but mostly has. That might be from the Russian help, which they, you know, from know-how that the Russians got in the war with Ukraine, because Starlink was and I think still is, like a big tool for the Ukrainian armed forces against Russia. And the Russians have started using Starlink as well. I'm not really sure how that works. So I think they have that kind of know-how now, which would be interesting. Yeah. So that's where we are. And as I said, in the meantime, like Trump has sent is sending like the I think it's the USS Abraham Lincoln and you know some fleet from the South China Sea towards Iran and is moving more ships there. But
well, you know, Iran is not Venezuela.
I know, and, I know. It's really hard.
If they try that again, I imagine a lot of our listeners are far too young to know about the last time the U.S. tried to slip a guerrilla force basically into Iran. That was an utter debacle.
I think they all know that, and I would think, but I don't know, that the idea would be to bomb, to do decapitation strikes, as they call it. I don't know what that would achieve, yeah. and I'm not sure that the Iranians would be as measured this time as they were last time.
No, but it would, at the very least, impose chaos, and
yes.
The Israeli and pro-Israeli factions in the U.S. government would like that. That might satisfy them.
I've already seen pretty big name lobbyists in Washington linked to Israel, linked to Azerbaijan, already posting these maps of broken up Iran because, of course, Iran has large minorities. The Persians are barely a majority. And so there's like Persianistan, and then there's Kurdistan, and then Northwest, and then there's South Azerbaijan. Azeris make up a huge minority. In fact, I'm pretty sure Ali Khamenei background is at least partly Azeri, ethnic Azeri. There's Balochis in the east, there are Arabs in the southwest. And so they're talking about, and you know, we're not surprised, openly breaking it up. They're doing this with Russia too, less so now, but in the Biden years, the pro-war think tank crowd, they even started up organizations, the free captive nations. It's like straight out of the Cold War era, the captive nations.
Yeah, that name.
Yes.
Captive nations, that just brings back memories of sad causes, hopeless causes, as they seemed then.
Yeah. Dirty causes, too. You know,
right. It's like and very, very dirty as well, yes.
So they've, you know, reconstituted that, and you have like the leader of free I don't know, Chuvashia, and the leader of Free Buryatia, and the leader of
Free... I got a soft spot for the Buryats.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Go Buryats.
They're cool. And so on. So they want to break up Russia. And then the other... But it's that has really not gone anywhere. And, you know, what has all of the National Endowment for Democracy efforts to accentuate repression in Tibet and Xinjiang been about? It's been about trying to destabilize and potentially break apart China. It's again, just an old strategy. If we were hundreds of years removed from it, we wouldn't even feel much particular emotion about it. Be like, oh yeah, that's what that state did because they're an empire. They're trying to break up their rivals.
Yeah, they just allocated 2% of their budget to that and they just kept giving it up to this corrupt group of local oligarchs, and it vanished in gin parties or whatever.
and you know, the problem again is that, and I'll wrap it up here, if there is a regime change in Iran, and a lot of people know this, and you hear the current anti-Iran neocon crowd even saying this and so on, that whoever were to take over, there's it's extremely unlikely that what would emerge if the state is whole would be a Václav Havel, like the Czech Republic, pro-American state. That given Iran's history and the, you know, how deep sort of pride and nationalism runs, the size of Iran, this is a country of 90 plus million people. I think the majority of them are under like 45 or something. So it's a young state that...
Lots of wars,
and that they're not going to be subordinated. They're going to be a power in another sense. And for a while, they wouldn't be sanctioned either. Like, it would be a regional China, potentially, you know? Yeah. And I don't think, I definitely Israel doesn't want that. And I don't think a lot of the U.S. deep state wants that either. So, you know, the goal is to break it up. And I think we have to look at everything that's being done right now is geared towards the goal of fracturing, shattering the Iranian
and
state.
And I don't think that's a very smart goal either, because sometimes some monstrous entity comes out of the ruins and stomps across the world.
Okay, on that happy note, let's end this episode. Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Brendan, John, and talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.